Exomoons and lunar cameras. You're listening to Are We There Yet? The radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. We've talked about planets in other solar systems that orbit stars light years away, but what about moons? Exomoons are moons that orbit a planet in another solar system. An astronomer and professor at Columbia University, David Kipping, is leading a mission to study one special moon. We'll speak with him about how you study a moon in another solar system. Then, NASA is gearing up to send humans to our moon, and for us Earthlings who can't step on the lunar surface, we get to see the moon missions through a camera. Nikon and NASA have once again paired up to create a camera to capture the moon like never before. We'll speak with Jeremy Myers and Jonathan Pryor about the project and how these cameras will withstand the moon's harsh environment. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? David Kipping is an astronomer and professor at Columbia University and led the discovery of an exoplanet 5,500 light years away from Earth. Circling the giant Jupiter-like planet is a new moon that Kipping and his team have spotted. The team will continue to study exomoons using the Webb Space Telescope, using infrared technology to see the faraway moon. He joins us now to talk about this mission and what this moon could tell us about other exomoons. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me here.
You have found an exomoon candidate and plan to study it with the JWST. First of all, what is an exomoon, and how did you find this bugger?
Exomoons are something that we've been interested in looking for a very long time, pretty much ever since we first started finding exoplanets. An exoplanet, remember, is simply a planet which orbits a star outside of our solar system. So any star other than the sun, essentially, that means it's an exoplanet if it goes around one of those. And an exomoon is just very simply a moon around one of those exoplanets. And I don't think really the question is, if they're out there. I don't think that's the reason we're doing this experiment. In the same way that when we looked for exoplanets, we weren't really surprised when we first started finding them. It totally made sense they'd be out there. But it was actually the nature of those planets which truly surprised us and has taught us so much, revolutionized our understanding of planet formation and our own uniqueness. And I think in the same way, discovering exomoons will surely hold many great surprises. I have to say, just to correct you, this actually wasn't a candidate.
Okay.
This wasn't a candidate. So we have previously reported two candidates. One was Kepler-1625b-i. Another one was Kepler-1708b-i. These wonderful license plate numbers. They're basically two Jupiter-sized planets that have surprisingly large moons, if they're real. They're kind of like in between the size of the Earth and Neptune. So, you know, when we first saw those, we're like, who ordered that? A lot of the community has been pretty skeptical, including ourselves. Like, how do you get such a big moon there? We actually did ask the Hubble Space Telescope to chase after those objects, and Hubble weren't that enthusiastic about it. And so we thought, well, my goodness, with JWST, it's going to be even harder because that's, you know, an even more competitive telescope to get time on. And so actually what we did, we changed strategy. And rather than asking to go after these kind of more controversial candidates, we sort of scratched the slate clean and went after a brand new exoplanet. It's called Kepler-167e. I discovered it about 10 years ago. It's kind of nice that I personally discovered this planet, so I'm kind of happy about that. And it is a Jupiter analog. It resembles Jupiter in every way that we can conceive. The mass is within 1% that of Jupiter. The radius is within 10%. It has very similar temperature and a wide orbit around a sun-like star in a multi-planet system. Everything is just as close to Jupiter as we could get. And of course, that raises the question, does it have Jupiter-like moons? And JWST is the first telescope humanity has ever built that could detect moons as small as those around Jupiter. Those are small little moons, and yet JWST could get them. And so that was our proposal.
David, you really make me feel like I haven't accomplished much in my professional career since I have not discovered an exoplanet much like you. Kepler-167e, was that discovered with the Kepler Space Telescope? Is that why it has that name?
Correct. So usually when we name a new planet, it's named after the telescope which discovers it for the first time. So yeah, it was a Kepler planet. It was, you know, the 167th confirmed system of planets. And E means it's actually the fourth planet in that system.
You use this transiting method to kind of identify these exoplanets. planet candidates. Is that how you chase exomoons as well, by the transiting method, or how do you actually find them?
Yeah, there's many methods people have proposed to look for exomoons, but the one that we are using is indeed the transit method. So these things are in perspective much smaller. So they're called just a very small dip in starlight. And it's those dips in starlight which occur once every orbital period of that planet. So that gives us the year of that planet by monitoring the timing between those dips. And the size of that dip tells us how big the planet is. And so if there's a moon there, we should see not just one dip due to the planet, but some smaller dips or even multiple dips around it, which could even be in motion as well. And that's pretty exciting. You can get the entire mini solar system around those planets from these little dips in starlight. And JWST will indeed be looking for those.
And why is JWST a good tool to use it for? I imagine these small dips are, you need something very, very sensitive to pick them up. Is that the case?
There's a couple of advantages to JWST. One is just simply, it's a very big telescope. It's 6.5 meters in diameter, whereas the Hubble Space Telescope, which is our previous largest space telescope, is 2.4 meters. So it's more than twice the aperture. That gives you a lot more photons to collect, which beats down your noise. The other thing is the instruments are newer. So they have better sensitivity than what Hubble had. They're also more in the infrared, as probably anyone who knows anything about JWST has heard that. It's an infrared telescope rather than a visible telescope like Hubble was. And that also has some advantages. And when we look at stars, they're not like light bulbs. So we talk about these transits and, you might imagine just a perfect flat line of brightness. Like the star is the same brightness in every single image you take. And then all of a sudden, the star gets maybe 1% dimmer or something. But in reality, the star's brightness is constantly changing due to all sorts of effects. And that makes the analysis really complicated because you have these little extra wiggles. And then you're trying to figure out, is that wiggle an exomoon or is that wiggle something with the star itself? Now, the nice thing of going to the infrared is that all of those intrinsic stellar variability effects are suppressed as you move towards the infrared. So everything gets just easier and easier for us as we go towards the infrared wavelengths. The difference is the wiggles from the star itself get smaller and smaller, but the dips of the moon stay the same size. And so they stand out more against that background noise.
So viewing in the infrared is helpful. I'm wondering if, as we know, JWST has discovered quite a few exoplanets in its kind of first phases of scientific observations. Is what you've learned from these first discoveries on JWST kind of helping you with this campaign to search for these exomoons?
Kepler was using a wide field camera. So, on your iPhone, you've got the wide mode and the telephoto mode. Think of JWST as being like the telephoto and Kepler as being like the wide mode. And so you can observe millions of stars simultaneously with Kepler. And that means you can monitor the brightness of all of them all at once. And so you can detect many, many dips all over the sky. And that's how it found so many planets. JWST is a much narrower field of view. And so it can only really look at, a handful of stars at once. And so that's why it's not a particularly effective tool for discovering telescopes, because it can only do one thing at a time. It's not the best use of the telescope. Instead, we tend to point it at stuff where we already know there's something there that's interesting. So in this case, we know there's a Jupiter-sized planet and we know exactly when it will transit in front of its star. So we can optimize the observations to be like, this is the moment to look. And in those moments, what do you see? And so a lot of the previous observations of JWST have been leveraging its ability, its incredible precision, but on known exoplanets mostly, in order to measure their atmospheres, which is one of its unique abilities. It can actually characterize the molecular composition. So it's been detecting things like sulfur dioxide, methane, water in the atmospheres of many exoplanets. And it's enabling us to measure the chemistry of other worlds. So we're doing something a bit different, but actually we will be able to do that for free at the same time. So we'll also get the chemistry of this giant exoplanet whilst we're doing this experiment.
And so ideally, would you want to investigate every exoplanet that JWST has discovered and look for these exomoons? Is that the plan?
We are very cognizant of the fact this is, taxpayer money. I'm a US taxpayer, and I know I've spent money on this machine like everybody else. And I don't think it's the best use of the telescope time just to just to spend 10 years looking at one planet at a time, looking for exomoons, it only makes sense to go after the very best things. And so we have a handful exoplanets which we think are really well suited for having exomoons. They're far from their star, they're Jupiter-like or even Earth-like, and the stars themselves are close enough to us that we can get some really good data. And I hope it's just the beginning of a campaign where we can monitor maybe a dozen of these things over the next 10 years. And that would actually give us the frequency of which Jupiter-like planets have Jupiter-like moons and even Earth-like planets. Another one of our programs that we proposed to JWST, it didn't get accepted this time, but I'm optimistic we'll get it in eventually. We have an Earth-like planet that we also proposed to look at where we could detect a moon-like moon. So as in our moon around that Earth. And so that's pretty interesting because then you can really get a handle as to whether we're special. You know, the moon is thought to have had a big influence on our own planet. Do other Earths out there similarly often have moons like our own moon? Or is there something unique about our origins? So there's some really interesting questions to be answered by this telescope.
Well, how will those answers help answer some of the bigger questions we have about our universe and our place in it? Is this research and these types of observations getting us any closer to answering that question? You know, are we alone?
And when I talk about exomoons, I always highlight this basically probably four good reasons, I would say, just to simplify it, to look for them. One is that they could be habitable themselves. If you've seen, you know, Avatar, it's all based off this moon Pandora, which is perfectly habitable. Star Wars with Endor. Like, the idea of a habitable moon is not unusual. We've seen that in sci-fi, and so it makes perfect sense that that could be out there in the universe. The other reason is that they could influence the habitability of the planet they go around. And obviously, the moon around Earth is the canonical example of that. So when we find an Earth twin, one of the first questions we were going to want to know is, does it have a moon twin? Another reason, a third reason, is just to try and understand how these things form. Our understanding of planet formation, as I mentioned earlier, was totally revolutionized by the discovery of exoplanets. We found things like hot Jupiters, Jupiter-sized planets, which were scorchingly close to the star, almost skimming the surface of the star. And again, no one had predicted that. It totally changed our understanding of how planets form and evolve. And similarly, we'll probably have many surprises with exomoons. In our own solar system, there's many open questions like, how did our moon form? I mean, there's the giant impact hypothesis, but we don't really have direct evidence to support that. So finding more of these things would be great. And then finally, we want to eventually take photos of other planets. We're already kind of doing it, but only for the very, very hot young planets, which are in the process of forming. We'd like to one day build a successor to JWST. It's currently called the Habitable Worlds Observatory, that will take an image, a pale blue dot photo of another Earth. That's kind of the dream for many of us. And the moon will also be in that image. It'll be photobombing that image. There'll be the pale blue dot of the Earth, but there will also be the pale gray dot of whatever moon is going around it. And we need to be able to disentangle those signals, because one of our big goals is to look at that signal and hopefully detect the signature of life, biosignatures. We're not going to be able to do that unless we know how often there are moons in there, how they influence the planets, and how they influence the combined spectra.
And finally, David, what is it like to kind of work in this field and see this kind of pace of discovery when it comes to exoplanets and exomoons?
Well, it's a dream job, I have to say. I really do feel blessed and lucky to be working in this very exciting field. I think a question we often get from students is the gold rush era over? And if you look at like San Francisco, you know, 100, 150 years ago, whatever, there was the gold rush on the West Coast. And people were always wondering, you know, has the gold rush era finished? Is it worth moving over? And students kind of wonder the same thing. Like, has the exciting era of exoplanets mostly passed now? And we'll be doing more gravitational wave astronomy instead. The explosion of discoveries is still in its infancy for this field, for sure. We only know of 5,000 exoplanets, but there's 100 billion stars in our galaxy alone. So there's absolutely no shortage of stuff out there still to discover. We've barely scratched the surface, and there's surely all sorts of extremely exotic things out there that will totally blow our minds when we find them.
So you're saying there's still a chance for me to find my own planet out there? Is that what you're saying?
There's only less than 10 billion. There's 8 billion people on Earth, and there's 100 billion stars. So there's more than enough. Everybody can have 10 planets each just to yourself. So don't worry about that.
You know what? I will leave the finding up to the experts like you. You just come on the show and chat about it. So David Kipping, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Still to come, cameras that are out of this world, That's ahead on Are We There Yet? You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Brendan Byrne. NASA is preparing to launch humans back to the lunar surface in the upcoming Artemis missions. It will be the first time astronauts have been on the moon in more than 50 years, and those of us back here on Earth will get a glimpse of the lunar surface thanks to the photos and videos the astronauts will take. But to do that, NASA and Nikon are working on building cameras to withstand the moon's harsh conditions. The handheld Universal Lunar Camera mission is led by Jonathan Pryor, project manager, and Jeremy Myers, technical lead. Our producer, Marion Summerall, spoke with them about these fascinating cameras and how they will play a big role in the Artemis missions.
Jeremy, Jonathan, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having
Thank
us.
You.
Yes, thank you for being here. And we've got a whole wave of moon excitement this year. I feel like it's all I'm talking about is the excitement of going to the moon. While humans are making this grand trek back to the moon, let's talk about your role in this project of developing some of these cameras that astronauts are going to be using while on the lunar surface.
As we're developing the Hulk, it's handheld universal lunar camera. This is a camera that'll be used IVA as well as EVA. So IVA would be internal to the vehicles. EVA will be on the lunar surface. We've been working with Nikon to ruggedize one of their cameras to be able to withstand the environments on the lunar surface. And also we're doing customization within NASA with blankets and grips to allow this camera to work on that lunar surface in those extreme environments.
So what kind of conditions is this camera up against? I mean, how is this camera going to be different than maybe the camera that, let's say, like I have in my closet?
Yeah, I mean, some of the environments are a lot more challenging, I think, than a lot of people realize, right? The how cold it gets, how hot it gets, those are two extremes that we have to design around. You have a vacuum as well. So thermal issues become a concern. And additionally, radiation effects. When you're on the lunar surface, you don't have the same protection that you do on Earth. So you have to consider radiation effects and how those impact electronics.
Yeah, well, when we think of the radiation effects, it's basically order of magnitude worse than if you were just in orbit around the Earth. So this will be challenging because modern electronics, feature sizes on these electronics are so small. You have a charged particle flying through the universe, comes in contact with your electronics, and it can have a destructive effect, or it can simply flip a one to a zero or zero to one, and your camera or other electronics will totally change what they're doing. So there's a lot of work that has to be done on the radiation side to just do appropriate mitigations and ensure your hardware is going to survive.
Obviously, you can't test this equipment. You know, unfortunately, we can't just hop on, you know, rock and go to the moon real quick and test the equipment prior to using it in some of these upcoming moon missions. How are you testing some of this, like those protections that you have to use in the camera against some of the moon's environment?
Yeah. So thermally, we use thermal vacuum chambers. So those are chambers that you have that can pull a vacuum in a canister, allows you to test your hardware and allows you to control the temperature of that chamber to test your extremes. So we have, you know, that capability, and those are tests that we run, as well as radiation tests that Jeremy's been a part of.
So we'll perform those radiation tests. Some are done at medical facilities. We'll do proton testing. If you hit a device with enough protons, you have secondary events, so you get an idea of how it will react to heavy ions. But for heavy ion testing, really you end up at national labs or particle accelerators, and very difficult to get time in those facilities, but it really gives you an understanding how your hardware is going to react basically to the galactic cosmic rays that are flying through the universe.
And just kind of going back, what are some of the ways that you are developing this camera? You know, are there any special features that you are incorporating to protect against some of those harsh environments on the moon?
One thing that, going back to radiation, we keep focusing on that. We're not worried on Earth about radiation events. But a simple solution, when you have a problem with any electronics, what do? You turn it off, you turn it back on, or you pull the battery. You call tech support, that's what they usually tell you. Turn it off. Why did I call you for 3 hours to hear that? But the same has to be done with this camera. And that wasn't originally designed into this Nikon camera, but we created an interface and ability basically to do a hard reset to allow the camera to come back when we do have an upset, which basically freezes the camera.
And then, you know, outside of the camera, some of the stuff that we're developing here internally would be, you know, the blanket around it. So that can be designed to help with the thermal effects. So that's very specifically designed to help you not get too hot, not get too cold, but try to find that right medium based on how it's used and the environment it's going to be in.
And along with that blanket, you can imagine the astronauts are going to have gloved hands. It would be hard to use a camera with those gloved hands. So we've made a very specific interface such that it's not taxing to the crew, and they'll be able to use the camera in an efficient manner to make the best use of their time and really to capture the story, so everyone on Earth will be able to see what we've done.
This is the first time coming up with these missions that we are going to see photos of the moon like never before, and really since, you know, the first Apollo missions. If you put some of the cameras that were used in those first moon missions by some of the cameras, you know, that you are working on, what would you see? I mean, besides obviously decades of technological advancements, what are the big differences that maybe something you learned from studying that those old lunar cameras, what are some of those big differences?
So when we think of when we went to the moon last time, I say we, I wasn't born yet, but the challenge there was much different than the challenges today. Back then, basically, a camera was a mechanical item. Now it's an electronic item. So you didn't have the radiation challenges that you have now. You are using film. All of those things actually create really great images. And that's why when we look at the iconic images of the Apollo program, they're spectacular. However, you couldn't downlink that data real time. Someone on Earth couldn't look at the picture you just took, which could help in possibly picking out lunar samples. So from that standpoint, it's going to be much different in the way that we can use this tool compared to what they previously were able to do.
And, you know, with more modern technology, you're able to just, you know, use automatic settings to help set your exposure time and your ISO and all that stuff. So that's an advantage, too, that, you know, a lot of modern cameras have the ability to do all those calculations internally and come up with the correct settings for the scene.
So while they're on the lunar surface and these astronauts are able to take photos, what kind of photos are you hoping that they'll be taking? I mean, you said earlier, this is really the way that they tell the story for every, I'll say, Earthling here excited about this mission. Really the way that they are connected is through these cameras. So what kind of photos are you both, I guess, hoping to see?
Well, one thing that should be noted is not only will we see photos, another thing that's different about this camera is it can take videos as well. A picture's worth 1,000 words, but a video's worth 1,000 pictures. So it will help just capture that story beyond just the photos.
So, I mean, there's going to be a lot of documentation of the work they're doing, what they're seeing of each other. And a big, you know, objective for us is getting back good science images, pictures of the lunar surface, things that could be used by science to help analyze makeup of the lunar surface.
And how do you think people are going to react to seeing pictures, but also, like you said, videos of astronauts walking on the moon and seeing the surface like never before? How do you think people are going to react to that?
Well, we just had the eclipse, and we saw how people reacted to that. When people experience something that maybe once in their lifetime, it can be surprising how we react. I mean, we'll have the first woman on the moon, so that will be inspiring to many. The first person of color on the moon, that will be inspiring to many. Really to all, I should say, for both of those things. And we get a whole new generation of kids that this is going to really direct them. And of course, STEM is so important, not just for children in this country, but all around the world. So that's the beauty of NASA is we kind of are able to inspire people across the world because we all look up every night, we see the moon, and it really can unite us.
Yeah, no, I think it'll be very exciting when images come back. And I hope that it you know, is very engaging for people across the world to be able to see those images and experience that. The photos are really what connects you, you know, to the folks that are going to be up there exploring.
I will say this camera really has even inspired the agencies around the world because we've had the privilege of working with the astronauts in developing this. That's been in analog missions. It's been glove box tests where they see if the ergonomics are appropriate for them to use. So it's been exciting for our team just to have that interface and then to see the excitement of the astronauts. I remember one astronaut held up the camera and they said, "This is why we're going back to the moon." So it's really going to be exciting because it will tell the story that unites humanity for that moment when we return.
Well, Jonathan is the project manager and Jeremy is the technical lead for HOLC, the program that is making some really cool lunar cameras. Jeremy, Jonathan, thank you so much for coming on the show. And I cannot wait to hear more about what kind of images and videos these cameras take.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to this show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, the NPR app, or really wherever you get your podcasts. If you've got more space coverage online, visit cfpublic.org/space. Are We There Yet? Is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Our intern is Emily Ching. Editorial guidance from Latoya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet? Comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.